broadcast out of New York City. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, January 21st, 2013. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on the Progressive Radio Network every Monday live from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember, our shows are available 24/7 on PRN.FM.
Today you're going to hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour. And we got another great show for you today that's going to include the CDC says the 2013 flu is now an epidemic. Here we go again.
And is Coca-Cola another Philip Morris?
And why are patients so rarely told about medication errors?
How to prevent amputations in diabetes.
And how do trees and human health go together? There's an interesting stretch that'll make a lot of sense to you.
Well, here we go again with the seasonal flu scare. The flu's been declared a public health emergency in Boston, New York. This has been in the headlines of the newspapers this last week. And the flu seems to make the headlines every year around the same time. And the story is much the same. They exaggerate the statistics. They push vaccines, yet claiming that there's shortages to get the pandemic going, it seems like. Now, if the vaccines are so successful, why do we have epidemics? And how is it that so many people in Boston have the flu that they're in field tents? What is going on? Is this really the worst flu season since the 2009 H1N1 swine flu?
You're talking to the CDC, the exaggerati. You know, they're just an incredible group of people. I think we should get rid of the CDC. You know, they give us so much false information. They cover it up. They won't give their information out, even with Freedom of Information Act. You can talk to CBS News about that.
And they guess?
Oh, they make statements that are just nuts that actually, when you think about it, aren't nuts at all. Because what they're geared to do is support the pharmaceutical industry. And it's about that conflict of interest that we're always upset about on this show. So we have to take what they say with a grain of salt. And when they say that we already have an epidemic in New York and Boston and declare a public health emergency, I just get stunned by things like that when the whole flu thing is blown out of proportion every year anyway.
Well, you know what else is interesting? The CDC says that the flu vaccine is 62% effective. And yet they recommend it to everybody over 6 months of age. And it doesn't really stop the flu. I mean, I guess they say that it reduces severity and pneumonia. So what do you think of that?
Well, it doesn't. I mean, that's been studied. This is stuff that they make rules by proclamation, not by good science. And the problem is you just can't believe them. If you look at what it says on the insert of the flu vaccine itself that the pharmaceutical company puts out, it says that 50% of people will respond with an antibody response that's strong enough to probably give some protection. And 50% of those actually respond to it. So one person in four, that's 25%, are likely to respond from the flu injection. Now, that's not a very good record.
And you know what else is that every year the strains are different.
Uh-huh.
And this year they said that they forecast that the vaccine strains were correct. But yet they're claiming that it's an epidemic and people are getting the flu shots. They're really encouraging them. And
look, Vicki, the real bottom line is this. Who needs the flu shot? They're the ones who are the ones who will respond to the infection the worst. So those are immunocompromised people who have cancer, have AIDS, have other severe chronic diseases that are limiting. Their immune systems aren't going to respond to it. So who takes it? The people who are strong and young.
They don't
that
need
have
it
good,
anyway.
Right. And then you have to worry about what are you actually doing? I mean, look at one of the worst things that happened as far as the number of deaths is concerned. Say there were 282 kids that died from the flu back in 2009 when they had the swine flu epidemic. So 282 out of several million is a very small number of people who are going to die from this disease. Is it worth giving that much, that many people vaccine to prevent that number of deaths? The answer to me is it's very marginal.
What's the percentage? Did you figure the percentage? The
percentage of people who die from it? About 1 in 1,000 will die from it, and about 4%, that would be about 40 people out of 1,000 will be hospitalized from the flu. But when you look at the total numbers that we have of people who are affected by this, and you look at the total population of the U.S., you're looking at numbers that make no sense.
Well, the Cochrane database said that the vaccine in kids is the same as placebo. So,
well, yeah, that's right. There was no benefit to it all. I mean, there were several studies done, and you talk about the elderly. There was no reduction in pneumonia in a big Lancet study that was published in 2008. And you just talked about the fact that the Cochrane database looked at 51 studies and 260,000 kids that were aged 6 months to 23 months, and there was no benefit.
And there's no benefit to people that have had chemotherapy. So, in fact, maybe that would make it, would that give them the flu?
Well, it,
you know, a lot of people,
if you
get
did flu mist,
it
certainly would. If you did flu mist, yes. But let's look at some more of the articles here that are the hard data that show that the flu vaccine is a scam. In 2008, in Archives of Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine, they showed that there was no impact, no change in the number of hospitalizations or MD visits from the flu epidemic if they had been vaccinated. There was no change in the death rates from the 1980s to the present time, when about 15% of people got the flu shot then, and now about 65% of the people get it. So there's something weird about what the government is doing that make you think that they're stupid, but you have to keep in mind that they're not stupid. They're really very intelligent. They know exactly what they're doing. And you have to read between the lines if you want to try and figure it out.
Well, like, didn't the government buy something like $7 billion worth of vaccines?
Yeah. Why would they do that? What's the point of that?
And then they say there's a shortage.
Well, that's because they want to sell all that $7 billion worth of stuff that they bought. So they give the vaccine company a profit to start with, so there's no risk here. They get $7 billion up front. Then they protect them from the damages that could result from lawsuits. And they do the same thing for Tamiflu.
Now, a lot of ads on TV for Tamiflu, and that only shortens the flu by a day or something, right?
One half day to one day, it shortens the course of the illness. And while doctors are all assuming that people who are in the hospital who have a viral illness that could be influenza, that they do a lot better if they get the flu vaccine, maybe they don't do a lot better. We know that it shortens the course a little bit, and it may make the illness more mild, but I'd like to see the data on that. Nothing has been published that I've seen on that.
There sure is a lot of pressure for people to get the flu shots. I mean, it's not like just driving by the pharmacies and seeing those sandwich signs out in front of all of them, but when people go to the doctor and, you know, it's in their chart that they haven't had the flu shot. They put a big red sticker on the front, and they all pressure you to do it. And then they make the workers wear masks. We've talked about that before.
Well, that's just a terrible thing. I've had doctors and nurses and other staff come to my office and say, how can I avoid taking this flu shot? Because when I go to work, they single me out. They try to embarrass me.
Wear a mask.
Well, you wear them if you don't. Yeah, if you don't get the shot, you're supposed to wear a mask. And of course, the people who have had the flu shot get a little sticker that they put on their lapel or something.
Like I voted, you know.
Yeah, right. So you're a good guy.
And you just mentioned earlier that there's no change in death rates since 1980s.
That's right.
And now.
That's right.
A lot of years.
And even when the number of people immunized
have had
gone up 5 times.
Even when they've had a vaccine. So, and why don't people pay attention to this? It's like,
well, the government's scaring everybody. I mean, look at the hype from just what's happened
just
in New York and Boston this year.
They just ignore the facts and bring up other things that they want you to hear.
Well, what happens when the mayor of your city declares a public health emergency? You think, oh, man, there must be something really wrong here.
And then they set up all those tents in Boston.
And there's nobody in them, actually, when you talk to people.
Oh, really?
No.
Set them up to look good on TV.
Maybe. I mean,
I guess it's not funny, but this is ridiculous.
Well,
you know, there are complementary alternative things that people can do. You know, there's natural things that people can do for the flu. But, you know, sometimes you can get in trouble for suggesting healthy things because the government wants you to take the vaccine.
Yeah, at all costs. Look what they did to poor Andrew Weil back in 2009 when he is saying astragalus might be useful in helping relieve some of the symptoms of the swine flu. I mean, they shut him. They basically gave him a cease and desist order and said that if he didn't do retract that, that they were going to come after him and do things like make him pay back everybody who bought astragalus from him.
What is astragalus?
Well, it's an herb that has some nice immune boosting properties, and there are lots of herbs like that. Olive leaf extracts, another one. You look at things like maitake and shiitake mushrooms; it'll boost immunity.
Or how about some garlic? You know, season your food with extra garlic.
Absolutely. The biggest thing that's missing is the stuff on vitamin D. It could be that these viral illnesses that we see, like influenza and many others, I mean, there are a lot of others that are in the same class as influenza, are a disease of vitamin D deficiency.
Really?
We know that when you correlate the vitamin D level with the people who are coming down with these illnesses, that those that have the lowest vitamin D levels are the ones who have these illnesses.
Wow.
So in the wintertime, when we don't get any sun, which is that produces UVB light to any significant extent.
Which is why this becomes flu season.
Yeah, well, if you don't have the UVB light, you cannot make vitamin D. So unless you supplement, you're not going to have enough vitamin D.
And even if you are outside in the wintertime, you're probably bundled up because it's cold.
If you don't have direct UVB light, which is only present between 10 and 2, okay, in the morning and early afternoon, you will not be able to make vitamin D. It doesn't go through clothes. It doesn't go through clouds or smog or fog. It doesn't go through glass. So you can't stand on the inside of your house where it's nice and warm and sun and expect to get very much UVB. So supplementing is what is necessary. And that should be the first thing that we do. Because if our immune systems are weak because we don't have enough vitamin D, it's no surprise that that's going to happen. And that would be at least as effective, in my opinion, as this silly flu shot.
Mm. Well, other things that are helpful to boost the immune system, if you're wanting to prevent yourself from getting the flu, are things like the elderberry and zinc and homeopathy, Chinese medicine. There's lots of herbs with that, mm-hmm. curcumin,
yeah.
Vitamin C.
Vitamin C can be terrific at helping to boost immunity. If you're low on vitamin C, you simply aren't going to have those natural killer cells, that immune system cellular side of it that fights the viral infections that we have. The natural killer cells fight cancer and viral infections. And if we're low in that, we simply can't fight them. So there's a lot to lifestyle.
And the things we didn't mention with lifestyle are getting enough sleep and exercise.
That's huge. I mean, just sleep by itself.
And eating right.
If you miss one night of sleep, miss 5 hours of sleep one night, your immune system, your natural killer cell level will drop 30%. And what do you think happens? Why do you think we have so many colds in the wintertime, particularly amongst kids and college students?
Or during finals.
Yeah.
Not getting enough sleep.
You don't get sleep. You're under a lot of stress. Your immune system goes south. And the next thing you know is that virus that you could have resisted had you not been under that situation wouldn't be an issue.
And you might not be eating healthy either. You might be eating more sugar.
Sugar's a big deal because every time you drink a soda, okay, that has the high fructose corn syrup in it or sugar, your immune system is basically going to be suppressed for about 8 hours. So if you had 3 soft drinks a day or 3 fruit juices a day, your immune system will go south. So this business of drinking orange juice when you're sick is a myth. What we should be doing is taking vitamin C to try and replace what we need from that, but not the sugar.
Or maybe eat the whole orange.
The whole orange is a lot different. I mean, when you have a glass of orange juice, you may have 3 or 4 oranges in there. If you eat the whole orange, you're getting the pulp and the fructose that's in there is different than the high fructose corn syrup because you get the poison, which is the fructose when you have fruit, but you also get the antidote, which is all the fiber and other nutrients that are in the fruit
flavonoids
that protect lots of different kinds. There are thousands and thousands of nutrients that Mother Nature puts in that to protect us from the effects of sugar itself.
Well, the other thing is many times in the winter time or when people are studying for finals and so forth, is that people aren't getting enough exercise because they don't want to go out in the cold or mm-hmm. they, you know, whatever it is. Or
well, exercise boosts your immunity unless you overdo it. And if you run a marathon, okay, a 26-mile race,
you might overdo it.
You will have overdone it and you will be, your immune system will be suppressed. But if you are just in shape, you do a lot better. So there are lots of things that we can do that make a big difference in terms of how we can maintain our health so that we can not get these infections. And if you want to believe the CDC's data, you're just a fool. Because I know that when I reviewed this topic in great detail in 2009 and followed that whole debacle of the swine flu pandemic, I wrote a paper called The Infection Deception. And I invite you to go to my website, drsaputo.com, and read that paper. It's free. In fact, the website is free. There are no charges for any information on the site.
You were also just interviewed on a radio show called Ground Zero with
right.
Craig Lewis.
Yeah, yeah. It was a nice 2-hour.
You talked about it for a couple of hours about the flu, and it's probably archived on that site. Ground Zero.
Yeah, you could do that. I mean, if you want to hear me talking for 2 hours about the flu, that's a place to go. You won't have to take a sleeping pill towards the end.
Well, also, we have fast tracks on it on our website, and each one of our fast tracks are only about 5 minutes.
Well, yeah, I mean, the site is really terrific from that point of view because we've got 2,300 audios and videos that Vicki and I have made together. I've interviewed somebody who's a world-class expert in some topic. And they're all short so that they're right to the point. You're getting information you can trust. And again, it's all free. The other thing that's interesting about the website that I might just mention is we have 33 health assessments on it. And what we do is we will give you a short assessment to take that's under 5 minutes. It's multiple choice or yes or no, so it's easy to do. And when you're done, what happens is you instantly get back information that is in audio and video that will help you to understand what you need to know to do better with that chronic illness that you have. So it's quite a resource from that point of view. But back to the flu here, we have to start thinking for ourselves. We cannot trust the CDC, the World Health Organization, the White House as it comes out with some of the ridiculous things they said back in 2009.
They want us to panic is what it seems like.
Well,
it
works. I mean,
in 2009 they said it was a pandemic and it really was just like a cold. And
it was a pandemic, which means...
Well, because they changed the definition of pandemic, and it was about the number of people, not how sick they were.
Well, pandemic should be about multiple things. And certainly, it needs to be in multiple countries. That makes it pandemic, okay? But the definition before the swine flu came out, just before it came out, was changed so that morbidity and mortality weren't factors that had to do with the definition of a pandemic. So when they went to level 6, everybody thought, oh, my God, this is like the Spanish flu in 1918, and everybody's going to die from it, and we've got a global emergency on our hands. Well, it was bunk. There were fewer deaths than the predicted 36,000 deaths that the CDC says we have every year, which they admit themselves is a made-up number. They don't track 36,000 deaths
every
year.
And the people that did get so sick and died were people that were really immune compromised. They already were sick.
Well, look at the kids who died. At least half of them had diseases where their immune system was compromised. They had MS. They had ALS. They had all kinds of muscular dystrophy. They all had immune suppression, those 50%. And there were only a very small number that died who were in good health. It's the immune-suppressed people that you have to worry about the most because they're the ones who are the most vulnerable, and that's the one where the vaccine doesn't work. So we've got a problem on our hands where the truth that comes from people like me is outside of the mainstream. It's not what the average doctor will tell you. And you tend to think that in numbers, we've got things all worked out, but we don't. It's not about numbers. It's about doing your own research and getting it right. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on PRN.FM, and I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. It's time for Vicki's first 2020 tip on motivation to help you lose weight. And when we come back, we'll be talking about, is Coca-Cola another Philip Morris?
Looking at Deborah Enos's website on how the best way to start a new diet and exercise plan is to motivate yourself. So I have a few motivational quotes to get you going. One of them is, strive for progress, not perfection. So in other words, don't compare yourself to other people. Just focus on the improvements that you've made in your own life. And so many people spend their health gaining wealth and then have to spend their wealth to regain their health. You want me to say that again? You're looking at me funny. So many people spend their health gaining wealth. So
that's
in other
true.
Words, when they're healthy, they're trying to get wealthy.
That's true.
And then they have to spend their wealth to regain their health.
Beautiful. It was right on the mark.
So that was written by somebody, A.J. Materi. So this quote's a good source of ammunition against the I'm too busy excuse, because when we say that, it's often because we're focusing too much on work or other people and not enough on ourselves.
Right.
And here's another one. This one's by David Walters. An hour of basketball feels like 15 minutes. An hour on a treadmill feels like a weekend in traffic school. But isn't that the truth? You know, when you're
doing... Depends on who you are.
Well, when you do something that you love, exercise isn't a chore. Mm. And it could be reversed, you know, if somebody likes doing the treadmill.
Mm-hmm.
But the key to making exercise a part of your life is to avoid those traffic school workouts and try dance or yoga or Pilates or the basketball or tennis or
That's
whatever you like to do.
Great piece of advice.
Zumba.
Definitely. Right on. So that's a great tip.
So, you know, Coca-Cola, they're airing commercials to address obesity or to promote their diet drinks. You know, their solution to obesity and diabetes is smaller cans. And I was thinking, well, maybe that's also so you would buy more cans.
Well, maybe.
And then better tasting artificial sweeteners.
Uh-huh.
And I thought that the timing was pretty interesting, with New York banning soft drinks in larger than 16-ounce containers. So that just sort of fits right in with that. They're pretending that part of the solution is instead of what the problem is.
Well, it's like giving the fox all the job of guarding the chicken hen. The chicken coop, because that's just exactly what it's about. I mean, they are definitely part of the problem, because high fructose corn syrup is a big issue, and so are the artificial sweeteners, even though that hasn't really taken effect with most doctors or with some of the major organizations like the American Diabetes Association. It's insane to me to think that artificial sweeteners are the answer. All that's doing is setting the stage for you to continue with your sweet tooth. And of course, when you look at the studies that have been done with artificial sweeteners on animals, they get fat and they get lazy.
And their appetite increases.
Exactly.
And we talked about a lot of that last week, the dangers of artificial sweeteners. But, you know, what could they do if they were serious? You know, they could
stop producing Coke.
But that's their business. That's their money.
Well, does that justify what they're doing?
Well, they're trying to sound like they're good guys because...
Well, they sound like the tobacco industry. I mean, look at Philip Morris, for God's sakes. They're saying they're putting millions and millions of dollars into advertising to convince kids not to smoke. But what do they do at the end? They put their big emblem there and they show pictures. I mean, and they've got T-shirts
And it's really to pump up their image, you know?
Of course it is. I mean, anybody can see through that, because what they're doing is trying to protect their business, and that's what it's about.
You know, one of the Philip Morris ads confused the kids because the kids thought it was a pro-smoking ad.
Well, it probably was in a hidden sort of way. I mean, this is a move that's a full-blown exercise in damage control. That's what it's about.
Well, Coke's pretending to be part of the solution, and really, they're the problem. And, you know, if they could stop opposing taxes on soft drinks, that might, you know, but they...
That'd be a small step. It's like hiding the real problem. The real problem is that sugar and high fructose corn syrup are not good for you.
But they taste good to some people.
Well, they do.
Personally, I don't like Coke. I've never in my whole life liked Coke.
I used to drink it like crazy when I was a kid, and particularly when I was playing, when I was an athlete playing tennis tournaments. I'd drink, and it wasn't so bad in that setting because we would burn it off as soon as we put it in our bodies. We were needing calories, and if it was sugar or it was fat or it was protein, didn't make a whole lot of difference. But when you look at the comparison between fructose and alcohol, you know, fructose is actually alcohol without the buzz. One can of beer and one can of Coke, okay, that's full sugared or high fructose corn syrup, has the same effect at causing cirrhosis on the liver as a can of beer.
Really?
So what you've got here is a situation where something, all the soft drinks that have fructose in them or sugar in them put you at risk for heart attacks and strokes, for cirrhosis, for metabolic syndrome, for hypertension, for gout, and for being overweight. Now, it tastes good.
So don't order a rum and Coke.
No, that would be the double whammy. That's right. So we certainly got something here that's a big issue that that they're trying to hide from. They're looking like they're good guys saying, well, we'll just give you a little bit of poison. You know, we'll give you less because then it won't have the same massive effect as if you take more.
Well, what they're doing is working because they're making a lot of money and a lot of people are drinking it. And a lot of people think that it's not so bad if they drink a Diet Coke because that's the way it's promoted.
Uh-huh.
But those artificial sweeteners are just really, those might even be worse for you than the high fructose corn syrup.
Learn more about that. Go to, again, to drsabuto.com and put artificial sweeteners in the search box. And all the stuff will come up that will teach you about what each of those artificial sweeteners do and why they're not such a good idea for you. So when we're looking at the Coca-Cola company, I don't look at them as any different than the Philip Morris company because they're trying to do the same thing. They're trying to let you think or convince you that they're good people trying to protect you. And what they really are is a corporation that's interested in what? Making more money. Because who are they responsible to? It's their stockholders. They're not responsible to you. They want to convince you to buy it so their stockholders will make more money. That's what that deal's
about. Well,
they're
a big sponsor of the Olympics and a lot of sporting events.
Sure.
And also on big TV shows like American Idol. And
they'll pay $1 million or more for a 1 minute ad because it works.
Or 30 seconds even for like on the Academy Awards.
Well, for the bigger shows, that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, Coke spent $611 million advertising in 2011. Can you imagine that? More than $500 million.
So you know they're making a lot of money to make it worth it to spend all that on their ads.
Well, I mean, again, their job is to protect their stockholders and to make a profit. And what it does to people is of no concern for the most part, unless they can do it and it's good for people. But they've got a product that's a loser from that point of view. So America needs to wake up. We need to start taking more responsibility for our health. We need to start educating ourselves about what's healthy for us and what's not. We need to shift over to lifestyle medicine and enforce the education of that so people actually know what's good and what's not good for them. And diet is a huge part of that.
You know, it's making me laugh, though, too, when I think about how they say they're going to make the smaller containers. You know, Coke used to come in a smaller bottle.
We used to pay a nickel for a Coke.
But I'll bet you now, I bet when they do that, they'll probably charge you the same amount for less in there. I bet you they will.
Well, they're going to do a change that's not going to interfere with their return on investment. That's about.
New York, see, they're going to ban those 16-ounce half-liter.
Well, I mean, that's kind of like treating a little bit of the symptoms without going after the problem. So you can't buy a bigger container than 16 ounces. I mean, my God, how much do you need? I've had people walk into my office.
Well, you could go buy another bottle, I guess.
Well, you could buy two of them at once.
But I can't believe how big some of those are. They're huge.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have patients who come in with 2-liter bottles of Coke or
to
Pepsi.
To your office? Don't they know better than
well,
that?
Well, they don't do it more than once. They don't usually do it more than once. And a lot of the time, it's the low-cal stuff. You know, it's the artificial sweeteners. But that's not the solution. I mean, that's just, we need to change our approach to what we eat. And it's a very complicated topic. There are many reasons for why people get overweight. and they are all understandable if you'll take the time to figure it out. And if you do, then maybe you have a chance of making some changes, because it's not going to be by proclamation. So here we are. It's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health Radio, and we'll be talking about why are patients rarely told about medication errors. So stay tuned for more Prescriptions for Health Radio. Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki.
A U.S. study finds that patients and their families are rarely told when hospitals make mistakes with their medicines. And they also found that most mistakes are made in the ICUs, where the patients and the families are less likely to be told. To err is human, so medication errors are expected to some degree, but how many are really being made and how do we prevent them?
Yeah, see, that's a problem, because medicine is far too complicated. Doctors cannot learn what they need to know about the side effects of drugs and the interrelationships of many drugs when they're taken at the same time. It's not unusual for a patient in the hospital to be taking 20 or 30 drugs.
Whoa.
That is an experiment every single time, because we don't have any data that tells us what happens when we use combinations of drugs, especially with that kind of a number.
And when you talk about side effects of drugs, I mean, if you ever look in a PDR, the physician's desk reference,
yeah,
sometimes in very teeny tiny print, page after page, will be
90%.
The side effects of maybe just one drug.
90% are that way. The benefits of it are real short and sweet. And the trick then becomes to be a seasoned practitioner who has had experience with the use of these drugs and can at least make a guess as to when it should be safe. But there are major limitations in what we do there, because we simply don't know that much about drug interactions. It's unrealistic to expect our doctors to master the pharmacology that's needed to do this, even though a lot of the time we do very well. And that's proof of the pudding of why this article came into print.
Well, and this is when there aren't mistakes. And now we're talking mistakes.
Yeah.
And sometimes too much is given, or the wrong one is given. Or
it's not given when it should be given. That's right. I mean, when you look at this particular article, which looks at Johns Hopkins, okay, Medical Center, you're talking about a top medical center in the U.S., it stuns me at how limited the information is and how dishonest it is in presenting it. Because what they did is they looked at 840,000 voluntarily reported medication errors from 537 U.S. hospitals over a six-year period from 1999 to 2005. Now, the thing that disturbs me is, if you work out the math here, that comes to just 261 errors per year.
Well, you know, that's not accurate.
I mean, there would be months when you would expect to make way more than that. So you got to get real and not try to fool the people that you're writing an article trying to convince them that really we're pretty good. And the problem is that we may be very good at what we do, but the system is not workable. It's too complicated.
That doesn't mean
that our patients in ICU don't go in very sick and come out amazingly well, because they often do.
But it's also been found that a blame-free reporting system increases the number of reported mistakes.
Yeah, well, how
people
could you?
People are afraid to report it. You know, they're afraid of the consequences.
Well, they're liable to get sued. They're liable to be called by their medical board. They're going to be on the, you know, on the list of the hospital that is looking at people who are making errors, and it's embarrassing. I mean, this is important stuff, and making it so that they're not. So that it's nobody knows and it's anonymous, not going to really happen, because I don't think that stuff can be held back from the patient should something go wrong. And the problem is we don't tell the patients, because we don't want them to know. We don't want to let them know that we're making mistakes.
Well, nobody wants to be sued.
Well, they don't want to be sued, for sure.
It's a mistake, and they're not doing it on purpose.
Well, look at the number of errors that are covered up.
Well, they're and they're trying to do things to make it safer. You know, like they have these barcode type scanners for the patient's wristband to make sure that you give it to the right patient.
Well, that's a good start. But what's the underlying problem here? One, the system's too complicated. Two, there aren't enough nurses who are dispensing these medications. And you remember how busy you were when you were on the floor?
Oh, yeah.
And then you're behind and you can't catch up and people are having a problem and you have to dispense medications. And so you're rushing. You don't have time to listen. And so you wind up giving the wrong pill to the wrong person. And sometimes the doses are miscalculated. Look what happens when you miscalculate a dose of chemotherapy. Oh, my God. Talk about a disaster.
Yeah, and you have to be able to do the math. There's a lot of things to know. You know, the Institute for Healthcare Improvement a few years ago reported that there are like 90 times more errors than are admitted by the practitioners.
And that may be a conservative estimate, because when you talk about 400,000 deaths every year in this country from medications, from pharmaceutical drugs.
Well, just imagine, what if you made a mistake and you killed somebody?
Right, well, it happens.
I mean, you'd feel terrible.
Well, look,
you'd be scared to death, and you wouldn't probably want to admit it.
Well, you may have to sometimes. I mean, look what happens when they're doing renal dialysis. And there have been cases where they cleaned the tubing out with formaldehyde.
Oh, I remember that happened.
And then they injected the formaldehyde instead of what they were supposed to. And, of course, that's embalming somebody alive. These things do happen, and it's a big deal. So we have to find a way to first get more honest about it. You know, when there are 400,000 deaths every year from medications and 100,000 every year in this country from the expected side effects of pharmaceutical drugs, and there are far more than errors, don't give me numbers like 261 errors per year at a hospital like Johns Hopkins.
You know that's
outrageous.
Yeah, you know that's not the truth.
No.
Especially if there's 106,000 deaths just from side effects.
Yeah. Well, it's just something we have to learn to deal with better. I think we need to move from a disease-oriented system to one that's more health-oriented so that we don't get so sick and wind up in the ICU or in the hospital. And that's very doable. But we're not doing much about it. We didn't have health care reform back when we had this Affordable Care Act come into power.
Well, you know, too, I've noticed that so many things are downplayed. Like when people are admitted to the hospital for surgery,
mm-hmm.
It's just like, you know, the problems we've discussed before about your complications with the anesthesia when you had your hip surgery. I have a friend that just went in and had a simple shoulder surgery. And they ended up giving her a nerve block, and then she couldn't breathe.
Yeah.
You know, and then she's still in the hospital. It's been several days, and she's really sick.
Being in the hospital is a big deal. Thank God we have doctors who do as good a job as they do in the hospital.
It's just that once in a while there can be problems.
And not once in a while. It happens all the time.
So when you sign those papers, you know, you got to read them and stop and think, this could happen.
Well, it does happen.
You know, because usually when you talk to the surgeon, they try to tell you everything positive and how you're going to be so much better.
Well,
everything.
When you go in the hospital and you're about to sign the forms, you get this thick packet of forms. You're sick to start with. You're not going to read it carefully. And all kinds of things are in there that protect them. I mean, I know a lot of the time, even, you know, we reported a story on eye surgeries and how often the doctor that was in charge of the case that the patient had employed to do the surgery didn't do the surgery. The residents did.
Oh, yeah.
Now, if I'm paying a lot of money and I'm going out of my way to find a doctor that I want to do my surgery, it sure as hell isn't going to be a resident unless there's no other way to get that done.
I made sure I told that story to my eye doctor before I had my cataract surgery.
Right.
Well, it's like, don't even think about having somebody else do this.
I know. Well, anytime you go to a medical center or a teaching hospital, that's a risk you run. And they don't tell you that point blank outright. What they'll do is be in the fine print, you sign it, and that's the deal. Then if something goes wrong, it becomes your problem because you have to live with it. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't have residents learning. We should. But it needs to be disclosed, and if it's going to be that way, you should be informed so there's no question about it. There are lots of ways to go wrong when you're sick, And the answer, of course, is to not get sick in the first place. So we need a combination of different ways that we can manage patients. One of them obviously would be that we have to do the sick care system. We're always going to need a sick care system. We're going to need ICUs and CCUs and critical care units.
Emergency rooms.
Absolutely. But we could do a lot less of it if we took care of ourselves, and that's for sure. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on idiot sightings. That should be interesting. And when we come back, we'll be talking about how to prevent amputations in diabetics, and do trees and human health go together? That's going to be a good one. Stay tuned.
Have you ever heard the expression, a stupid idiot?
I have heard that before.
Well, I have some true stories from Kansas and Alabama. And, you know, it's important to laugh at ourselves. And these, remember, are true stories.
Well, you're going to get some letters from Alabama.
Well, this one is from Kansas.
From Kingman, Kansas.
I live in a semi-rural area, and we recently had a new neighbor call the local township administrative office to request the removal of the deer crossing sign on our road. And the reason was because too many deer are being hit by cars out here. I don't think this is a good place for them to be crossing anymore. That's what her reason was.
I see.
That was the new neighbor.
Very good.
I guess the deer can't read the signs.
Maybe not.
Here's another idiot sighting in a food service. My daughter went to local Taco Bell and ordered a taco, and she asked the person behind the counter for minimal lettuce. And he said he was sorry, but they only had iceberg lettuce.
Oh, jeez. All right.
Okay. Here's one. I was at the airport checking in at the gate when the airport employee asked, "Has anyone put anything into your baggage without your knowledge?" To which I replied, "If it was without my knowledge, how would I know?" And he smiled knowingly and nodded, "That's why we ask." That happened in Birmingham, Alabama.
Okay.
And then we have another idiot sighting, this one in Wichita, Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
The stoplight on the corner buzzes when it's safe to cross the street. So I was crossing with a coworker of mine, and she asked if I knew what the buzzer was for. And I explained that it signals blind people when the light is red. And appalled, she says, "Well, what on earth are blind people doing driving?"
Oh, jeez.
And she was a probation officer.
That figures.
In Wichita.
All right.
So those are my idiot sightings.
Well, a little humor is good medicine, right?
Well, and like I said, you got to be able to laugh at yourselves. You know, don't take life too seriously. Don't get mad at me if you're from Kansas or Alabama. Every 30 seconds, a diabetic has an amputation due to a foot complication. And a Swedish study confirms that good shoes, shoe inserts, podiatry, and regular checkups can reduce amputations by 50%. You know, we all know that diabetics have a tendency to get ulcers on their feet and infections.
They
have to take really extra special care of their feet, and prevention is the first line of defense. And protecting the foot from overloading the sole of the foot by wearing insoles can actually minimize the risk of ulcers that can lead to amputations.
Yeah, well, this is a good thing to do, and you don't want to minimize that. I mean, when we look at the fact that the diabetics, see, about 50% of diabetics will get neuropathy that's clinical in a 10-year
period. Let's define neuropathy.
It's nerve damage to their feet, so that what happens is they lose sensation. The foot becomes numb, and it also becomes predisposed to a lot of pain. And the reason for that is because the defect in diabetic neuropathy is a lack of circulation, because the sympathetic nervous system is causing spasm of the arteries to the foot. And when the foot doesn't get, and the nerve doesn't get the blood that it needs, it doesn't function right. So it doesn't feel, it becomes numb, but it also becomes hypersensitive to pain.
But it's also dangerous if you can't feel sensation on your foot when you step on something, because then you can hurt your foot and you wouldn't even know.
That's what happens.
And then the next thing you know, you've got an infection, and then you've got gangrene, and you get your foot amputated leg amputated.
Well, that's right. So in 10 years, as I was saying, about 50% of people have clinical evidence of neuropathy, these kinds of symptoms we talked about. But 90% will have abnormal findings if you test their nerves to see if they're functioning right. So these people are at risk. Almost all people with diabetes are at risk for injuries to their foot. I know some people were numb enough, okay, in their feet that they thought they might have had something in their shoe, and you look down and they have a Coke bottle cap embedded in their foot, and they didn't even know it. That's how dense the neuropathy can be.
I remember one time we were actually being interviewed on a radio show, and when we got done, the host of the show said that he had diabetes and he had neuropathy, and you happened to have a portable photon stimulator in the truck that we brought with us. And because we were going to spend the night up there, and I don't remember what, we had a pain someplace that we needed to use it on ourselves. So we had it in the trunk. And so you asked him if he'd like you to give him a treatment. He said, sure. So you brought it in and you gave him a treatment, and he got done and he's like, ow, I just stepped on something. And his wife goes, you can feel, feel. And she was like so excited.
Yeah, you're right. Well, I'm not putting down what the podiatry people are saying, and this study that was done is a good one because it gives us information about what we need to know about what we can do in the mainstream of medicine to prevent these ulcers from happening. So I think good podiatric care is a must for everybody who has diabetes. But the fact of the matter is there's another system here that's way better than anything that we have in the mainstream. And that's what we're turning to these days in my practice.
But before we get to the treatment and what you use for this, I think we need to talk a little bit more about prevention, because we these things that we mentioned about the shoe inserts and the regular checkups, going to the podiatrist and all that kind of thing. But living a healthy lifestyle is so important to just prevent diabetes in the first place. But after the cat's out of the bag, then we have to prevent amputation. And if you hurt your foot, you know, like we said, it's hard to heal. So diabetic neuropathy is this common condition that's in diabetics. So when we can't feel our feet and we hurt them, and it can lead to the amputation.
Well, as I said, up to 90% of people who have diabetes after 10 years will have at least electrophysiological evidence of neuropathy.
And some people have poor circulation also in their feet and their legs, and that can contribute to getting an amputation.
That's different, actually, than having just a lack of circulation to the nerve. If the whole foot has an artery that's leading to the foot that's compromised, and you have peripheral vascular disease, that's another story. Mm-hmm. That's different from neuropathy, and it can be much more difficult to treat as well.
But, I mean, that's another reason why sometimes people get an amputation.
Absolutely. If there's insufficient blood flow and you have what's called claudication, meaning leg cramping,
your foot turns
when you exercise,
black
they can become gangrenous. That's right. And then you're looking at vascular procedures to preserve the circulation or amputations.
Yeah. So once you have a problem like this, what do we do to prevent the amputation?
Well, what we do, okay, is use infrared light at about 860 nanometers. And it's near infrared light, and it does shocking, amazing things for people who have diabetes. In my experience, it relieves the pain in two or three treatments of about 10 minutes, which is shocking to most people. And it really bothers me that medicine is a business first and a service afterwards, because this use of infrared light called photonic stimulation is effective in almost all the diabetics that I've treated, and I've treated hundreds of them. It's affordable, it's cheap, it's easy to use. The problem is it is not approved by the FDA, and I don't see the FDA approving it in the near future.
I thought they did approve it as a heat lamp.
As a heat lamp, but I can't say that the FDA has approved it to treat diabetic neuropathy, or they'll shut me down. But I can say that in my experience, I found that it's been very helpful. In fact, it's been revolutionary. And at the moment, we're doing a research. I'm personally involved in research at the University of California in San Francisco with a $7 million grant from the National Institutes of Health that's looking at treating people who have chemotherapy-induced neuropathies. So I know it works because I've used it in my practice for 14 years. Other doctors are very hesitant to believe it until they see it or their patients get it because it sounds so ridiculous.
I remember seeing a patient in your office one time when I was working in your office, and mm-hmm. he had a really bad swollen infected toe. Mm-hmm. And the doctors wanted to amputate his toe, and he came to you, and he didn't have to have it amputated. The photon stimulator took care of his toe.
Well, let's look at what the light does, okay? This infrared light, and this is documented in mainstream literature. There are plenty of articles on this. What it does is it increases circulation almost instantly, much like nitroglycerin does for people with angina, because it releases nitric oxide in the blood vessel wall, which gives instantaneous dilation and improved blood flow to that nerve in the foot that's not being nourished because it doesn't have enough circulation. That's one thing. NASA has done studies and shows the light penetrates 10 inches deep. It's amazing. 23 centimeters deep. And that it speeds up healing by about 50%. It increases lymphatic drainage impressively. It makes more energy for the cells of the body when you shine the light on it. Because, you know, gasoline makes a car run. ATP makes your cells run. And if you don't have enough ATP because you don't get enough nourishment from your blood flow, then it would be really helpful to be able to have more of this ATP in your body so that it can make the nerves work better. So basically, the light energy is being converted into chemical energy that does a lot. And then lastly, it does a lot to relieve pain. It's like most people with mild to moderate diabetic neuropathy that's painful, in about two or three treatments in my office using special equipment that is made by someone that I work with that's an expert in this field, they will be pain-free unless they're very unlucky.
All the diabetic clinics should have this.
It's, to me, a crime that this is not available. And I know that there are a lot of political reasons for why this is like that. The FDA should be bloody embarrassed that it's doing... It's making the efforts to stop this from going forward.
Well, you have a very powerful one. They do advertise some that aren't so powerful
some don't
on
work.
Television.
And they tend to do studies on those and say, what doesn't work? Well, I know it doesn't work because it doesn't have the right physics involved with it. But in my opinion, the stuff that we're using is far advanced. In fact, you can't buy it. But it's soon going to be something that's going to be in the mainstream because this technology is just too impressive. If you want to learn more about it, go to the website, drsaputo.com, and enter into the search box, infrared light therapy. And again, the site is 100% free. There is no charge for any information on it, but you do need to join the site to get the information.
DrSaputo.com.
Right.
We all know that being in nature lifts our spirits and it's healthy for our body, mind, emotion, and spirit. And plants in our homes take in the carbon dioxide that we breathe out, and in exchange, they give us more oxygen. Mm-hmm. Now, personally, I love trees, and I love looking through the leaves at the sky and giving shade and following the seasons as the leaves turn, particularly when I'm horseback riding. I like to do this and watch the birds and the squirrels play in the trees. And
sure.
We have a big oak tree outside of our window here, and I love to do that. And then also the deer and the other wildlife that are seeking shelter from the trees. And mm-hmm. just being in nature can bring us peace of mind and improve our overall health.
We were made to be in nature.
Well, the United States Forest Service just did a study on the emerald ash borer beetle and how it's killed 100 million ash trees in the eastern and the northwestern United States. That includes 14 states, including adjacent areas of Canada. And it threatens to kill 7.5 billion more in North America. And this is having a serious impact on human health. So how is this affecting human health?
A study was done in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine in January 2013 that showed that over 18 years, there were 15,000 extra cardiovascular deaths and 6,000 more lung deaths in those areas where the trees were gone as compared to those that were uninfected.
It makes me wonder, too, you know, it's an association. If possibly it could be the effect of the insecticides that they trying to kill the beetles with, too. You know, you don't really know.
Well, I think what we need to do is remember that we live on the planet. This is our home. And Mother Earth is something we should respect. And if we do that, I think we're going to do fine. If we don't, there's a good chance we're not going to survive at all. Okay, we're at the end of the show. We'd like to remind you that we'll be back to talk about what's new in the news and health on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on PRN.FM.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on DrSaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, a healthy lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a great week, and tune in next week to more Prescriptions for Health Radio.